from behind his polarized sunglasses. Once Carthage was a mighty power, he thought. Once warships from that harbor dominated the Mediterranean. Then came the Romans, the stolid, unimaginative, implacable Romans. No matter how many times Hannibal defeated them, no matter how many Roman armies were slaughtered, they came back with more. Always more men, more armies, more battles, until they wore Carthage into the dust. They demolished the city, house by house, temple by temple, stone by stone, until nothing was left standing. Then they sowed salt over the foundations, so that nothing would ever grow there again. Destruction more savage and complete than a nuclear bomb would have caused. The final humiliation was that the Romans themselves built a new city alongside the devastated site. It was the Roman ruins that al-Bashir stared at now. That is the enemy we face, al-Bashir thought. Ruthless, implacable, capable of raising armies against us, no matter how many times we batter them. We cannot conquer them in battle, he knew. We must conquer them from within. Get them to destroy themselves. Make them use their greed and their power against each other. That is what we will do with their power satellite. That will be the first step in our eventual victory over them. He heard footsteps clicking along the tiled walkway that led to this shady trellis. Nervous, quick steps. Turning, he saw the Egyptian walking toward him. Short, spare, his white linen suit looking half a size too big for him, a broad-brimmed hat covering his bald pate. Al-Bashir rose and nodded perfunctorily. Salam, my brother, he said, taking off his sunglasses. The Egyptian removed his dark glasses, too, and sat on the white-painted cast-iron chair beside al-Bashir's without waiting to be invited. Salam, he murmured. To what do I owe the pleasure of your visit? Al-Bashir asked, allowing the irony to show in his tone. The nine met as a whole only rarely, and even meetings between individuals were kept to a minimum. But with Western intelligence agencies' abilities to eavesdrop on telephone conversations and computer links, some face-to-face meetings were unavoidable.
The others grow anxious about your operation with the satellite, the Egyptian said. I have spoken to most of them. Everything is proceeding well.
The Egyptian took off his hat and placed it on the table next to them.
This business of your operative being arrested doesn't alarm you?
Al-Bashir allowed a small smile to curve his lips.
My operative is a chauffeur who was bribing an Astro Corporation employee for information. Nothing more. We understand he was the one who caused the explosion of their hydrogen facility.
The Americans have no inkling of that.
But if they have him in custody, they might get him to talk.
With great patience, al-Bashir explained,
he was in custody for merely a few hours. He said nothing. He is now free. American police are very restricted in their methods of interrogation. We have nothing to fear on that score.
The Egyptian nodded his round, bald head. Watching him, al-Bashir thought that in another time, another era, this man might have been a royal scribe for one of the pharaohs, instead of a planner of terrorist strikes. The Egyptian licked his thick lips, then said,
In the meantime, Randolph has flown his rocket plane. The test was a success.
All to the good, said al-Bashir.
You believe so?
With a small chuckle, al-Bashir said, If Randolph had been wise enough to ask my help, I could have been of great assistance to him. The Egyptian looked doubtful.
My brother, said al-Bashir, we want Randolph to succeed. We need him to finish his power satellite and put it into operation. Only then can we use it for our own purposes.
To kill many Americans, said the Egyptian.
Many.
Including perhaps their president and many of their Congress.
Really?
Really.
And the best part is that they will never realize we have attacked them. They will believe the power satellite malfunctioned. They will want to blow that satellite out of the sky.
Certainly they will tear Dan Randolph to pieces with their bare hands.
The Egyptian gaped at him in admiration.
Calmly, al-Bashir added, It will also destroy the political career of the only presidential candidate who might pose some problems for us in the future.
Indeed?
Morgan Scanwell, al-Bashir said. Him we will not kill, however. He will be humiliated, ruined.
And Randolph?
The mobs will tear down his buildings in Texas.
Turning to look back at the ruins of Carthage, he added, Perhaps they will even sow salt on the site of Astro Manufacturing Corporation.
Matagorda Island, Texas. Never let a woman leave a toothbrush in your bathroom, Dan reminded himself as he leaned over the gunwale of the ferry and breathed in the fresh salt-tanged air. It's like allowing the Marines to establish a beachhead on your territory. The sun was going down as the last ferry of the day chugged across the bay toward Matagorda Island. Dan had spent the previous night and all this Saturday with Vicky Lee, who had come to do an in-depth interview with him because of the successful flight test of the spaceplane. In-depth, Dan muttered to himself with a grin. Vicky was fun to be with and energetic in bed, but when she suggested she stay overnight at Dan's apartment instead of returning to the hotel suite she'd rented in Lamar, every alarm bell in Dan's nervous system started clanging. So he drove her all the way back to Lamar in his newly retopped Jaguar. The hotel there wasn't all that much better than the Astro Motel on the island, but Dan was glad she had decided to stay in Lamar. They spent the night together, and most of the warm, humid Saturday languidly poking around the town's meager shops. They had an early dinner in her room, in bed actually. And then Dan had kissed Vicky goodbye and headed home. Hope I didn't screw up the interview, he said to himself as he watched the sun sink into the scrub pines of the island. Aviation Week is the most important source in the industry. Well, he thought, remembering Vicky's passionate panting, at least I screwed the interviewer pretty well. The hangar was dark and empty by the time he pulled into his parking slot. His apartment was clean and shipshape. Tomasina took advantage of my absence, Dan thought. God, she even stocked the fridge, he saw as he took out a cold can of ginger beer. As he sat at his desk and booted up the computer, he debated adding a slug of brandy to the spicy fizzing soda. What do the Aussies call that? The answer came to him as his screen lit up. Brandy and dry. But as soon as he saw the list of messages waiting for him, he forgot about a drink. Jane Thornton's name was third on the list. He called up her message before any of the others. She was at the ranch in Oklahoma from the looks of it, relaxed denim shirt, reddish-brown hair pinned up off her neck.
Dan, I need to talk to you in private. I'll be flying down from the ranch tomorrow, leaving here at 7. Could you have your airstrip ready for me to land there, please? Don't call back unless there's some problem with that. Otherwise, I'll see you when I land at your complex.
That was all. About as warm as a form letter from an insurance company, Dan thought. But so what? Jane's coming here on a Sunday. Tomorrow. He jumped to his feet and headed for the tiny bathroom. I'd better take a good long shower, Dan told himself. Feeling like a teenager waiting for his date to appear, Dan paced along the base of the Astro Airstrip's pocket-sized control tower as he watched Jane's single-engine plane turn into its final approach, sunlight glinting off its canopy. The guys in the tower had told him the plane was a turboprop TBM-700, fast, pressurized for high-altitude flight, yet with a landing speed low enough to slip into small landing fields. Engine yowling, the low-winged plane touched down gently on the concrete strip, and then taxied slowly to a stop by the tower. Dan fidgeted impatiently, waiting for the hatch to open and Jane to appear. Don't be stupid, he warned himself. She's here on business, nothing else. It's over between us as far as she's concerned. But when Jane ducked through the hatch and stepped onto the plane's wing, he forgot all that. She was wearing a flowered western shirt and snug-fitting jeans. Dan raced over to help her down to the concrete apron.
Hi, good to see you.
Jane smiled at him.
You can let go of me now, Dan.
Oh, yeah. He took his hands from her waist. The pilot squeezed through the hatch and dropped lightly to the ground. Dan tossed him a set of car keys, then pointed to the company van parked by the control tower next to his own Jag.
There's a motel about 3 miles down the road, Dan told the pilot, pointing. They're expecting you. Whatever you want is on the house.
The pilot thanked him, and after getting a nod from Jane, went to the van. Dan escorted Jane to his Jaguar and drove her, with the car's newly installed top down, to